Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Johnny Miller, welcome to the podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. I've admired the way you've looked internally for, as I've been studying your journey, which I do for every guest. I go do a deep dive into this person, and I'm just very struck by how committed you are to the internal path. So thank you for coming here.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. That's very kind. Yeah.
So I guess an interesting place to start might be with free diving. How does free diving relate at all to the internal path? And just like explain how you got into free diving to begin with.
Yeah, that is a great jumping off point or place to dive in. I discovered free diving about three and a half years ago now. And I was actually going through a kind of grieving, pretty intense grieving process at the time. And I'd always loved the ocean. Like, I've surfed for the last 12 years. It's been a huge part of my life. And when I discovered freediving, I did this kind of five-day intensive training. It was kind of like bridging my loves of the ocean and of being in nature and of like pushing myself, because, you know, you have to hold your breath for like several minutes underwater, but also the calmness and the stillness and like finding that center within yourself where everything is okay, even if you're having like stomach contractions, which you do start to get after a few minutes. And so I started to describe it as almost like high stakes Vipassana, where you have to like be so still and so kind of in tune with your internal landscape, but at the same time you're like kind of pushing yourself. And through learning freediving, I think I cultivated a greater sense of my own like inner landscape. Because when you're like, as you go down from the surface, every 10 meters the pressure doubles, basically. So it's like being squeezed by the ocean, and your lungs go from like being their normal size to being half their size to being a third of their size, and you really feel that inside. And so the deeper you go, the more you have to just soften and kind of like relax into the pressure, which I actually think is a fantastic metaphor for the rest of life. Because normally when, you know, when we feel the pressure or the squeeze from overwhelm in the outside world, normally we tense, right? And that's normal. But with freediving, you learn to like, every time you go down, you equalize, and then you go further down, and then you're like, okay, oh wow, there's some tension in my sternum or in my belly. Okay, I'm just gonna like, okay, feel it, and then soften into it, relax, and then sink a bit deeper. And you just do this more and more and more, and the depth is almost like a reflection of your capacity to surrender. So it has been this wonderful, like, both just really fun kind of challenge, but also I think it's a beautiful metaphor for like how can we show up in life with that similar approach. When most of us do try and kind of tense and contract.
That's beautiful. How long do you actually end up holding your breath for?
It depends. You do static trainings. So I got my static breath hold. I was quite proud of this. I got it from about a minute and a half in the beginning to 6.5 minutes after wow. a few weeks of training. And then during a deep dive, anywhere between a minute and a half to 2.5 minutes, I tend to be on the slower side because I like to go really relax and pull the rope and be really mindful. Other people just kind of speed down. That's not really my approach, but yeah, normally kind of a minute and a half to 2 minutes and getting down to about 35 to 40 meters. So I don't know what that is in feet, but like over 100 feet.
Wow. And Have there been any experiences like close calls with death or anything like that? Because I imagine it's not a very safe thing to do. Or do you practice and make sure there are like safety precautions while you're doing
it? Yes, Yeah, fortunately, no brushes with death. but you always dive with a buddy. So someone will meet you halfway when you're on the way up, because there is a risk of blackout when you're in the last 10 meters. And so you always make sure you have someone kind of guiding you back up to the surface after a deeper mm-hmm. dive. That's the main thing. I haven't blacked out, not through lack of trying. that's all that comes to mind, really. I mean, there's also... Yeah, you just don't want to... When people used to train, they used to like hyperventilate on the surface, and that increases the blackout risk. And so it's really about how you do the breathe up in the beginning, which decreases the risk of blacking out, which therefore increases the overall safety. Because, yeah, and you have like a line that you dive down as well, and you're kind of attached to it by a lanyard. So if you drift off, you'll kind of get pulled back towards the line. Mm. But yeah, safety is a big component, as you might imagine.
Yeah, when you were talking about being guided back up to the surface, it reminded me of your own breath works. I don't know if you guide people in breath work or you just practice it avidly, but like, what is it like to work with a guide just in breathing in general, and what you do with the breath?
Great question. So... Where do I begin? So I've been training in a modality that we're calling facilitated breath repatterning. It's basically been created and invented on this island of Bali. And so the way that breathwork is practiced here is really different to anywhere else in the world. And something I'm really excited about is recording a documentary here and finding a way to share this particular modality with the rest of the world, because I think it's... The potential is incredible. But what is it like to work with a guide? Well, I do one-on-one clinical breathwork sessions, usually about 90-minute long journeys with guided to music. And the art and the science of guiding someone through a journey is basically reading their breath. So when someone drops into the breath, they're connected to their breathing. They're breathing from the pelvic floor up to through the three diaphragms. So the first diaphragm's down in the pelvic floor, and then the main diaphragm, and then the throat. And you're basically reading the breath to guide it through periods of like contraction or tensing, kind of like with free diving, and elicit more ease, basically, so the breath flows more naturally. So like a really common pattern might be like I'm doing right now, actually. Someone might be holding in the throat, and this is a really common we call it like the overachiever breathing pattern, where someone will like have a big breath into the chest, but then they'll be holding on the throat, and there's almost like a Darth Vader type exhale. And so there, we just kind of like gently kind of facilitate around the neck and around the jaw and just like soften. Sometimes I might be working to like increase the capacity of their lungs, so like pushing deep into the rib cage and just getting them to expand their breath and getting them to like find more energy and more power. Other times I'll be trying to get just like gently facilitate breath more down into the belly and into the pelvis area, because that's where we feel a sense of safety that allows us to relax. It's connected to the parasympathetic nervous system. And so it really depends on, it's like a constant conversation between their intention for the journey. You know, maybe they want to process a challenging or traumatic experience from when they were younger, or maybe it's they just want to have insights, or maybe they want to find more ease and relaxation. So it's kind of moving the breath and also reading what I'm seeing in the breath, and then being like, okay, what is it that wants to come alive? And there's a really interesting technique that's been brought in called nerve flossing, and this is essentially like unweighting limbs, and you just kind of like move the arm around. But when someone's in this altered state of consciousness, sometimes the limbs will just start to move on their own. So like my arm might start to like move up here. And as you follow that, there's often incomplete reflexes which start to emerge. And these incomplete reflexes are often connected to repressed emotions. And so by moving certain limbs, I might access maybe grief or something, if that's in this area. Or there might be anger is a pretty common one that comes through. And then in which case we do arm compressions, and people kind of let out a loud shout or a loud scream or whatever energy wants to come through. So yeah, I could talk about this for probably the entire podcast if you want me to.
it's fascinating to me. I'm curious what got you, you know, a lot of people find their modality and stick to it. Like for some people, it's like, oh, meditation is the thing that really helped me at a deep level. For other people, it's like journaling. For other people, it's like affirmations. What made breath work so appealing to you as a modality? Not to say that you're disregarding the others, but it seems to me from the outside that it's like you chose to focus deep on this one. Why that one in particular?
Yeah, great question. Great question. So I think that, maybe to rewind slightly, I feel like I've always been a curious person. I've always been I studied philosophy, kind of interested in these questions. And I've had a journaling practice for the last kind of 10, 15 years. I started meditating about 10 years ago, kind of just, you know, with Headspace and that kind of thing when it first came out. And I've always been meditation has brought me so many gifts in my life. I've done 10 days in a dark room, Vipassana, like many, many things. And it's been profound. But then 4.5 years ago, as I mentioned, I was going through this deep grieving process after I lost my partner, Sophie. And this really kind of opened me up to, I guess, some of the more like fringe modalities. So I ended up going on a 10-day vision quest in Nepal, 12 ayahuasca ceremonies in different locations around the world, in Colombia and elsewhere, Iboga here in Bali, just a number of different plant medicines. And when I discovered breathwork, this was actually kind of after a lot of these prior experiences, I was able to access a equally profound altered state of consciousness, but without using any kind of external substances or any like entheogens. And it was completely kind of under my own steam. Like I could, you know, you can stop breathing or just breathe normally at any point and kind of guide yourself through that process. And so what really drew me to go deep in this modality, it's a combination of the fact that it's so simple. Like, you know, we all just breathe the whole time. We don't even think about it. It's like something that we all have access to. And it's not realistic to think that everyone in the world is going to be able to or even want to sit through an ayahuasca ceremony or take MDMA assisted psychotherapy, because A, these aren't legal in a lot of places, and B, they're just not something that appeals to everyone. But the breath really is. And what I've really loved from studying under my mentor Ed, who's based here in Bali, is the kind of technical and like very scientific approach that he takes to breath work. So looking at the kind of shifts in blood chemistry that happen when we go into these altered states, getting really technical about the facilitations that are brought through and how breathing rhythms are essentially connected to different emotional states. And so if we're unable to breathe in a certain way, it's an indication that we might be unwilling to feel a certain emotion. And so what this is basically implying, and we're hoping to do research here in the Bali Breath Lab, but what this is implying is that by guiding people into breathing rhythms and patterns that they're generally unable to access normally, you're able to bring up these incomplete reflexes, which might be trauma, might be all kinds of things, and process them and then integrate them properly. And I think this is the key piece, is that when someone might go on an ayahuasca ceremony or like one of these big kind of peak experiences, they might have a profound time, but like, does anything actually change in the long term? Like what actually changes on the level of their nervous system, like in terms of neuroplasticity? And it might be, often I think it's not that much. But with breath work, you're able to actually change someone's breathing pattern and therefore change how they show up in their life, because the breathing pattern impacts their day-to-day blood chemistry and all these other things. And to kind of go back to your original question, I think journaling is fantastic. I think like, and I kind of categorize these as like top-down versus bottom-up modalities. Journaling generally top down, kind of mind based, and kind of changing the story that you're telling yourself is really important. Meditation, I think, is primarily top down as well, but can also be bottom up too. But something like breath work is really entirely bottom up. Like, it doesn't matter if you don't have any idea what the story that this intense experience might be connected to. It will process, it will complete, and you will feel like a more whole human on the other side, regardless of what it was connected to. And I really feel like this is kind of the missing piece in a lot of the conversations around healing modalities, because so many things are mind-based, they're top-down, like CBT, all of the kind of traditional psychotherapeutic techniques, talk therapy. It's working with the mind, and you can make progress, but you only get so far. And I really feel like breathwork is unlocking. It's like going into it's a bridge to the subconscious, which is where most of our stuff is stored. And you know, you can write affirmations for an entire year in a row, but if there's some kind of subconscious belief or something deeper than the surface level of the mind, nothing's actually going to shift in the long term. So I really think that finding effective modalities to work with the subconscious, and particularly with the body, are essential. That's a long
what
answer.
Would be no it's great, I love to hear it. What would be other examples of bottom-up approaches? Top-down is like it comes from the mind. Bottom-up means what exactly?
So bottom-up means it's working, it's from the body, and by changing your state, by changing your physiology, by changing your blood chemistry, you then have an effect on the mind. And so to kind of ground this in some neuroscience, we have these afferent nerves, which basically send signals from the body to the brain. And then there's also nerves which go from the brain to the body. And there's 80% more nerves that go from the body to the brain versus the 20% that go from the brain to the body. So it's actually a much more effective way of, say you can kind of apply this to like breathing practices. Like if you want to calm down, like you can kind of say to yourself, like, I'm safe, I'm calm, there's nothing to worry about. But if you just do, you know, 3 minutes of box breathing or alternate nostril breathing, you'll calm down much, much faster. And that will then have a knock-on effect of calming down your thoughts and calming down your mind. So that's kind of what the bottom-up approach talks to. And then there's other modalities, something like somatic experiencing is a great modality that was
kind what of is that fat.
It was created by Peter Levine, who is really a kind of pioneer in the kind of trauma space, and it's basically working with giving prompt. To give an example, say that I'm feeling really angry right now, but I don't know what it's connected to. The practitioner might say, okay, what does that anger feel like in your body? And I might be like, okay, it feels like it's tense and it's in my sternum. And then they might be like, okay, describe the shape and the color. And then I'm like, well, it's sharp and it's like, and then by kind of guiding the sensation, you can usually elicit whatever wants to be expressed. Maybe that's sound, maybe that's movement. So it's like another way of accessing this incomplete reflex, but through guided talk, as opposed to just allowing it to emerge organically through the breath.
And then would running and cold showers also be examples of bottom-up approaches, where it's like you're changing the body, which will then change the mind?
Totally. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Kind of just wanted to make sure I was getting it right and it was making sense.
Yeah.
With the, you have gone through now and done this nervous system mastery, is that correct? Mm-hmm. And how many times have you taught that course?
So I've just taught that course the once last October, and I'm gearing up for a second cohort in the next couple of months. Nice. But prior to that, I was leading masterclasses on emotional resilience through Jan Chipchase and Studio D, and I ran, I think, six of those. So this is the Nervous System Mastery is really the evolution of these masterclasses. And then also prior to that, I've been working as a coach for executives and startup founders for a number of years.
Yeah, cool. I wanted to just make sure we had that context there. But yep. Does the person you are today surprise you, the person that existed 10 years ago? Are you surprised that you've taken this approach to life? Would you have been surprised?
Yeah, I love that question. I would have been shocked. I mean, let's see, 10 years ago, I was deep in startup land. I was working on my startup Maptia that I was a co-founder of. And I was very much, I was, you know, loved traveling, loved surfing, was like trying to build this startup. We got backed by Techstars and we had funding, venture funding, all that kind of stuff. And it was just a very different life. And I really hadn't. And then, you know, going back even further to school, like I didn't know what any of this stuff was. I'm sure you're kind of the same, but like, it's like, I wish someone had told me this stuff existed, but it really has been something that would have been, you know, totally impossible to predict, even 5 years ago, to be honest.
What about all of what you're living today would be most surprising?
It's a great question. I think I've... What comes to mind is I think I've actually developed a lot more confidence in myself in the last few years. And it's, you know, it's not surprising that I'm living in Bali necessarily because I loved surfing. I am deeply in love with the woman that I'm married to, and that's obviously wonderful. Might have been surprising to my 19-year-old self. it's just like... I don't even know if surprising is the right word because, you know, my 19-year-old or 23-year-old self would have been like, what is breath work? Like, what does that even mean? Like, why would you be doing that when, like, because I was just very much obsessed with travel, with startups, with, you know, that whole world, that this really would just be completely foreign to me. Like, I wouldn't really understand it, I don't think.
I mean, I feel like I'm in the world you're in loosely, and I don't fully understand it, you know? So I think it's like you're on the cutting edge of something that hasn't really been explored by the general population yet. And similar to how you talk about meditation today, and everyone's like, yeah, meditation, of course, that's a normal thing to do. You have grandmas meditating, you have, you know, everyone will meditate, and they're even teaching meditation to kids at school. But breath work is not as practiced and as common, it feels like, in the Western world. And so, but I think that it's needed in a deep way. And so I think it's only natural that the world is going to move to breath work in the next 10 years, let's say. Do you share that same opinion and perspective? And if so, why do you believe that breath work is going to be next in society or next up?
Yeah, great observation, and 100% yes. And in fact, the here in Bali, Ed and the Breathwork Bali team have just built a breathwork specific shala that is kind of dedicated for breathing. And currently, you know, in most places, you know, people might rent yoga studios, or they might you know, do it in someone's house, but there's no like breathwork specific places, with maybe like a handful of exceptions. And what I hope is that the more kind of, let's say, rigorous and trauma aware versions of breathwork become the versions that are more widely practiced and understood. And I think the, you know, breathwork becoming more popular is absolutely inevitable in the next 2, 3, 4 years. I think it's already been exploding, and I think that will continue. I think what I hope is that the way in which it's practiced will be kind of respectful of the nervous system and respectful of what's known as polyvagal theory. So there's certain breathwork modalities out there which will basically, usually the much more intense styles. So holotropic is kind of an example. And what can happen is people will kind of blast through their window of tolerance. And if they're not able to kind of come back down and integrate, they can, there's a risk of re-traumatization kind of in this type of breathwork. And so the hope is that we'll go from one form of breathwork, which is still practiced, where, you know, someone will get 50 people in a room, they'll have a big sound system, they'll play intense music, they'll bang a drum, and people will be like having powerful experiences, but it's not actually supporting them on the level of the nervous system. If anything, it's making things worse. So the hope is that what will be spread, and a big part of this, I think, is there's an education aspect and kind of teaching people why there are certain protocols that need to be practiced in order to have a kind of integrated healing breathwork experience. But essentially having like a practitioner, you know, at least one practitioner for every 4 breathers, having hands-on bodywork ideally to help with co-regulation, safety and these kind of things. But in terms of the kind of the bigger picture, kind of what you were speaking to, I mean, the world is crazy right now. The world is absolutely crazy, and so many the rates of burnout are higher than they've ever been in the last like 2 decades, according to a bunch of different surveys and reports. People are afraid. People have been like cooped up inside for the last 2 years during lockdowns, and people need ways to essentially process emotional debt, is the way that I think about it. Like when we go through periods of intense stress, our bodies are able to kind of get through, but we accumulate this emotional debt, or it's known as allostatic load in like the neuroscience. And so breathwork is one of the most effective modalities that I know of for processing and relieving this emotional debt. And once people start to kind of like discover this and tap into this, it's just going to be so, it's also pretty simple. Like if you have a really well-trained practitioner, you just need a space, you just need some music, and that's it. You don't need the ayahuasca, the shamans, whatever it is. And so I really do think that it's inevitable, essential. And I think that I hope that it will continue to expand in the right ways, and a big part of this, as I mentioned, is the educational piece. So we'll see how it unfolds.
If somebody is going about doing breath work on their own, let's say they don't have access to a guide who's there with them, what are some of the best things that they can do or practice to make sure that they have an integrated experience for their trauma?
Yeah, great question. Firstly, I would generally advise against self-guided breathwork journeys until you've had sufficient experience with a practitioner, ideally in a one-on-one context. I think the kind of global recommendations is 10 private journeys before going in. But really, it's a case of like, can someone stay present with themselves and hold themselves through these kind of bigger experiences? And that takes practice. And for a lot of people, that might not happen right away. But in terms of things to be aware of, firstly, having just a feeling really safe in the space. So kind of, you know, obviously having a private space, ideally quiet. If there's other people in the house, then just knowing that there might be sounds or screams or, you know, whatever coming through. Having a playlist or music which follows the arc of a bell curve. So you want so say if it's 90 minutes, the peak would be about 40, 45 minutes through, and then having at least half an hour to come down, integrate and relax, where you're just It's essentially like an extended shavasana, kind of very light breathing in the belly to integrate. And that's when the real magic happens. Like, people don't realize it's not in the big experiences. It's in the integration and relaxation afterwards that the changes on the level of the nervous system actually take place. So that's essential. And what else would I say? It is really helpful to have both a practitioner to help to guide the breath. And if what can often happen is someone will stay kind of stuck in that intense activation phase and struggle to drop down into the relaxation, which is where having someone kind of like guiding the breath into the belly, kind of giving verbal cues, that kind of thing can really help drop into relaxation. But sometimes rolling onto the side as well can be helpful. Also avoiding tetany. Tetany can be common in kind of first time breathers, which is usually created by holding or tension in the throat. And so by softening the jaw, softening the throat, and having a kind of clear exhale. So instead of like, it's like a, so it's clear. That'll help reduce the tetany. If it gets intense, slow down the breath and then roll onto the side and just kind of relax there to the degree that you can. There's a number of things, but I think bottom line, I would recommend having several sessions with a trained practitioner before going into self-guided journeys.
You mentioned that the period of relaxation is really where all the magic happens and you really come to realizations or integrations. Could you give us an example of that happening for you, where you're in that last 30 minutes or you're just laying there, but you come to an important realization? Is there any way you could, anything come to mind?
I mean, so many things. I mean, several different things can happen during that phase. Sometimes there's just a kind of straight up DMT release, because the breath work will push cerebral spinal fluid up the spine, and it kind of tickles the pineal gland. And so during the second or during the final third of the breathwork journey, that's when DMT can be released, and then you kind of see a bright white light, you merge with universal consciousness, like all those things. So sometimes that happens, and that's like its own kind of type of insight, I guess. Other times there's more kind of mind-based insights. So one particularly powerful one that I had was being guided into noticing feeling and then expressing anger during a breathwork journey, and feeling not only empowered afterwards, but realizing that I had a kind of subconscious story from my childhood of, I'm not loved when I'm expressing anger. I'm not safe to express anger. When I express anger, I will be kind of kicked out of the tribe. Love will be withdrawn. And so realizing that I could feel love for myself even whilst expressing anger cleanly was so powerful, so powerful. And then that then translated into, you know, things like being able to set healthy boundaries and things like that, or, you know, stand up for myself if something was happening that I wasn't okay with. So there've been other really powerful moments around shame as well, and kind of feeling into shame is typically held in the pelvic bowl, kind of down in the pelvis, and kind of not being ashamed of the feeling of shame, if that makes sense. So just like witnessing it as a sensation arising and then bringing like loving awareness to that place, and feeling the freedom in my hips after these sessions is incredible. It's like, whoa, like I have so much more sensation and access down here than I realized. And I didn't realize how much I'd been holding on to. And I think that most of us, especially those of us that have been through like Western education systems, not to generalize too much, but yeah, I imagine that a lot of us have some degree of kind of internalized shame being held down there as well.
How does it feel to know that the education systems have set us up for, or have have not trained us in all of the ways of being.
I explored this in my own podcast, and I think initially,
of course, you did.
I felt angry. You know, like I felt like I was not taught like even 5% of what would be useful as a kind of functioning adult when I was younger, truly, like significantly let down by all of the, you know, education systems. And But then going beyond that, you know, you can easily see why that was the case when you kind of look at the history of the educational system. And, you know, it was essentially set up to create compliant factory workers in many ways. but I think for me, like the main piece is that it's not even about the content. It's just about the fact that we are kind of conditioned to give correct answers as opposed to asking interesting questions. And kind of being supported and loved through the process of like asking the good questions, because that's what all kids do, right? And it just gets slowly beaten out of them. And so like all that was needed from an education system is to just foster that innate curiosity. But instead the reverse happens, and it's only been for me like the last kind of 10 years that I've found a way to rekindle that sense of curiosity, kind of through the podcast, through conversations like this, all the things. And that has really been the gateway into stepping back onto the path of lifelong learning, which is, you know, it's crazy when, you know, why would you go through an education system and then stop learning when you leave school or you leave university? Because most of the information that we learned back then is now outdated to some degree anyway, because of recent, you know, scientific discoveries and updates. So yeah, I have a lot of beef with the education systems. But yeah, that's a brief answer.
I was listening to your incredible conversation with Leo Babauta. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah. But yeah, he's great.
I listened to an incredible amount of podcast episodes when researching guests, when, you know, just enjoying my time on this floating rock in space. I listened to an incredible amount, but I very rarely feel like I need to share that episode that I just listened to. And that was one episode. I highly recommend everyone check out Curious Humans with Leo Babauta. Incredible. Like the way you guys talked about the education system, how he's taking his kids out of it. And just like, he was a blogger that I found when I was 13 years old and I was reading Zen Habits. And that was one of the most exciting things for me. But in that conversation, you spoke about the power of intention and how you were asking the question of, can I set the intention to live a life that's more wondrous than my current self can conceive? And I thought that was such a powerful way of framing the world. So could you explain a little bit about that intention and if indeed it has come true?
Thank you for resurfacing that. That conversation was from a while back, and and you know what, this actually ties nicely back to the question that you asked me earlier around like, would I be surprised with how life has turned out from 10 years ago? And I think the answer is very much that, like, I could not have predicted the awe and wonder and love that has just come through in the last decade. Like, it's really been beyond anything that my former self could have anticipated or predicted or anything like that. And I think where this came from was, and while I was in the startup world, and I'm sure you can relate to this, I was very much kind of driven by setting goals for myself and achieving certain milestones and kind of saying, I'm going to achieve X by a certain date, and then like forging ahead for that. And that's great. Like, there's for sure a place for that. But I think what it left out was this kind of like, the poet David White talks about the conversational nature of reality. And what he means by this is that our experience of life is both the intentions that we set, but it's also things that come to us that we couldn't possibly have predicted ahead of time. And I think that there is such a beautiful art between setting clear intentions for like this is the direction that I want to go in. These are the projects I want to work on. These are the things I care about. This is what I'm passionate about. But at the same time, I'm open to new directions that might be even more interesting and exciting than the direction I was previously in. And, you know, an example for that, I think for my life was I was really into meditation. I was, you know, a meditation teacher. I was obsessed with it for a long time. I still do love meditation. But then breathwork came along and I was like, whoa, this is even cooler. This is even more exciting. And the same has been true in my partnership, in my marriage with Kelly. Like the relationships I'd had prior were just like on a different level to what we've been experiencing in the last few months has been on a whole different field that I couldn't have even imagined a few years ago. And it's just like, I love this process because it keeps things interesting. And it's like, oh, I actually don't know what my capacity for feeling good is, or for experiencing or wonder, joy, bliss, like these, or and the opposite end of the emotional spectrum as well. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
My pleasure. So in doing research for this, I found out that your wife met you through the podcast. Is that right? And she listened to every episode of the podcast before ever meeting you? And then you guys got married within like 12 days or something crazy. Like, I break this story down for me, and I was really curious about it.
It's not entirely true. We met out here in Bali, and I asked her for an interview on the podcast. That was my excuse of like asking her out on a date. And she was working as a sleep coach at the time, and I was like, "Oh, I'd love to have a conversation about sleep. Like, let's get coffee." and then we didn't. I found out that she had a boyfriend at the time, shortly afterwards, which was devastating. But then, about 8 or 9 months later, I was in the States. Was passing through. It turned out she'd just broken up with her previous boyfriend like a few days beforehand. I ended up staying in Lake Tahoe in her place at the time, and pretty quickly we just fell for each other pretty hard. And then ended up spending the quarantine together during COVID, moving to Mexico for I think eight or nine months last year. And yeah, we did a 10-day meditation retreat together actually in Mazunte in Mexico. And I did 10 days in the dark room after that retreat, and she then did 5 days in the dark room, and I proposed to her when she came out of the dark room that morning, and we got married 12 days later on the beach.
Oh my God. What is that like in the dark room? You go into a dark room and now someone proposes to you directly after that. That's like a crazy
probably
experience.
Incredibly intimidating. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was slightly surreal at the time.
but what was that experience for you like, going into a dark room and like, I've heard Aubrey Marcus talk about this, and but it's just so foreign to me, about like all senses off. Like, does it clarify things? How does it change your perception of this?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think everyone's experience is different to some degree. For me, the first kind of couple of days were just actually a period of like deep rest, because you know, your body finally gets a chance to fully kind of switch off. There is nothing to do. There is nothing you can do besides stretch and eat twice a day. Initially it's like an interesting experience functioning in the dark. Like even something as simple as like brushing your teeth. I still do this now, weirdly, actually. Instead of putting the toothpaste on the toothbrush, you put the toothpaste into your mouth directly and then find the tap and turn on the tap and then brush your teeth. But like even, you know, getting out of bed, just like basic shit, eating is an adventure. And the way the dark room works is there's like a double-sided door. Or like window, so they will knock, they'll open the door, they'll put the food in, then close it, and then you open from your side and take it out, so that no light gets through, and trying to figure out, like, from the smells, like, what, like, what's the food today? Like, can I eat this with my fingers? Like, I don't want to spill this everywhere. There's ants. I don't want to get the scorpions in here. So yeah, there's the logistical side, but from a kind of introspective angle, it's essentially just, for me, it allowed me to go a couple of layers deeper into the meditation practice. And I was going in after 10 days in a silent retreat, so I was already fairly kind of still and centered and was comfortable meditating for many hours a day. I think had I not had the capacity for a deep meditation practice, it would have been quite challenging. But for me, there was one moment in particular that I remember where it felt like I just felt this like joy and bliss come through for absolutely no reason at all. I was just kind of meditating, and it was, then I just started smiling, and I just felt this, I was like, why am I smiling? I just like felt so good, felt such like, I don't know if you've had this before, but just like your heart space just like really opens up with energy and presence. And so I was just like basking in that for some time. And then kind of towards the end, there was a period where I was like, I was having loads of ideas, and I was trying to write stuff down, and I was like using a ruler with my pen to try and keep it into a straight line, but like no idea if it was legible, like recording all of these like profound insights and then be like, am I going to be able to read this when I come out? And I was able to read some of it, it turns out, but not all of it. It was just, and I think there was also just an aspect of like, you know, what would it be like to spend 10 days in a room? Like, can I do this? Can I be comfortable? Not only comfortable, but like, can I feel joy with only my own company, with no external stimulus? And mm-hmm. I think that was a big part of it for me, because I noticed my tendency to get sucked into Twitter, sucked into the things I'm doing, and seeking validation from so many places that aren't from within. And so I think the central thing for me was like, can I find a way to feel really good, not just good, but like amazing and joyful with nothing coming from the external world. And then being able to take that experience back out into everyday life, just gives me much more of a foundation, I think, to stand on, knowing that I have that, knowing that I'm not reliant on these other sources of dopamine hits or whatever it is.
How different was your experience to your wife's?
So Kelly had a lot more visual experiences. So this is also something that's quite common. After 3 days, DMT will start to be released slowly as well because of the increase in melatonin. And there've actually been some interesting studies on this, and they get more and more intense after 5 days. And then for me, I was also seeing pretty bright white lights after like 8 or 9 days. But she was having visions of like underwater cities, in her experience. And I think she also has a very active mind. So I think she was also just having a lot of insights, kind of realizations. We were like writing messages to each other through the little trap door. And like we'd send food to each other as well. So like we'd be the ones like delivering lunch. So like my hand would be the one bringing the food in with like cacao or whatever, or chocolate or whatever was in there. But yeah, and she also found it just, I think, like a very powerful like reset as well. Just a way to like really just like reset the nervous system.
Is that something you would recommend people do? Like at what point should somebody consider going into a dark room for 5 days or 10 days?
Yeah, I would absolutely recommend like 2 days. I think 2 days would be good for everyone. If anything, just to catch up on sleep and just recover. I think for if you're kind of a relatively experienced meditator, then go for maybe 4 or 5 days. I think that would be a good goal. And if you've done Vipassanas and things like that before and you feel ready for a challenge, then maybe something like 8 to 10 days. Mm-hmm. The guy who was leading our Vipassana meditation retreat, he went in for, I believe it was 90 days after I after I came out. I haven't spoken to him since he's returned, but just the thought of 90 days in that tiny room for me was just like, whoa.
there are levels to the game.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah.
Oh my god. Well, speaking of the inner journey, Andrew Taggart is the name that's come up a lot, and I know Kay, I believe, also cites him as a mentor, and I've heard you talk about him as a mentor, and I'm curious why, what about him you're attracted to. I don't know anything about him. Who is he? Like, how did you discover him, and how has he helped you, if at all?
Yeah, great question. I actually spoke with him yesterday morning, this time yesterday. So I discovered Andrew initially, actually through Paul Millard, who is a mutual friend of ours as well. And he was writing about this concept of total work that listeners can look up. And he was basically just deeply questioning the approach to work that most of us have in the Western world, and asked this question, like, if work dominated every waking moment, would life be worth living? It's a pretty powerful question, and this essay that I think went viral just kind of brought up a lot of stuff in me. And I then spent time reading his blog and interviewed him on my podcast, and was very interested in this. I was really exploring different psychotechnologies at the time and different modalities, and so we kind of nerded out on that. And he is a deeply experienced Zen meditator, and he's also got a kind of background in the tech world as well. So he's one of the, I think I'm drawn to people that have experience in kind of, you know, the tech corporate world, but also have gone deep in their kind of like inner journeys. And yeah, I think what really impresses me most about Andrew, more than anything, like, he's an incredibly articulate philosopher, essentially. Like, he's created a living for himself by philosophizing with people, which I think is just is just beautiful. And he still has a kind of 3+ hour a day meditation practice, and he's basically found a way to, well, not found a way, but like deliberately crafted a way to live a very intentional life, where he spends his days meditating, climbing, writing, and philosophizing with people, and philosophizing also in the context of the gift economy, which I think is something that's remarkable in itself as well. So he doesn't have any set prices, but you work with him on kind of in the spirit of a gift. He's just one of those people that has very different opinions to the opinions in the mainstream. And it has also, I think, accessed some very kind of deep places through his Zen practice. And you can read his blog just to kind of get a sense for what he talks about and what he writes about. And yeah, I find him fascinating. And he's also in a one-to-one context, he's very good at like pushing your buttons and kind of asking uncomfortable questions and kind of like calling you out on shit, which I definitely appreciate.
What's an example of that?
Recently, I was just going through a challenge on my side, and he was like, it sounds like you're being like very understanding. You're being like very British and understanding about this. Like, are you sure there's not something deeper here? just like, I guess like playing the devil's advocate in helpful ways to help me get to, you know, whatever's actually going on.
I have this idea that the more inner work that somebody does, the more they can act as a clean mirror for your own perspectives, insights. And so you see yourself most clearly in those who have washed away, maybe, or analyzed themselves or gone deep on themselves. Do you also believe that to be true based on the things that you've learned and experienced?
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful insight. I think that the more we're aware of our own kind of patterns and tendencies, the less we are likely to project those onto other people. Which is often what happens, particularly in, you know, in a coaching context. Like when you start giving advice to someone, it's like you're really just giving that advice to yourself. or you're afraid to. I think the other, this is actually really key in a kind of breathwork context, or really any kind of therapeutic relationship, is that if I'm not comfortable expressing my feeling and expressing my own grief, anger, shame, then it will be almost impossible for me to hold space cleanly for someone else to feel the same thing, because I'll be resisting that. And so I'll be almost, you know, triggered or certainly not comfortable or grounded if someone's going through that. And this often happens in relationships, in personal or friendship relationships. Like if someone starts to like get angry or to express sadness, then if I'm not comfortable with that, I'll do everything I can to like subconsciously stop the other person from feeling that. Or, yeah, you know, maybe trying to fix the situation, or maybe it's like changing the subject, or maybe it's like, I can't take this, I'm just going to leave. And so, like, as you say, and I think Ram Dass articulates this most beautifully, but the more that we're aware of our own patterns, and it's not, I don't think that we ever get, I mean, maybe we do get completely like clean and clear, like maybe someday, but yeah, to the degree that we're able to, I think about it as like being comfortable expressing the full emotional spectrum, then we can be comfortable to kind of be with someone else who is also doing the same thing, whatever context that's in.
Okay, so let's work through this. One thing that came up for me when you're just speaking right now was I tend to judge those who judge. And now saying it is so ridiculous. Like you're judging those who judge. Like that's the thing, the very thing you're upset at is the thing that you are doing. How would I begin to work through that judgment of other people's judgment?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, that it's like the saying that like when you're pointing a finger at someone else, there's three fingers pointing back at you. and I think that also like the things which we judge other people for, and you know, we all do this. So firstly, like there's zero shame in it at all. Like the specific things that we're judging are actually really powerful reflections about the things that we're kind of maybe judging in ourselves, or things that can be something that my wife Kelly talks about is this idea of like golden shadows. And so we might judge someone else who might be, you know, successful in business, for example. We might judge them for whatever reason, but actually that might be a reflection of we're just afraid of our own kind of internal sense of power, and like we might be afraid of actually of achieving some success in ourselves. So I think that's one piece, is that the judgments can also be very helpful reflections into things that might be in our shadow, and positive things that could be in our shadow potentially, as well as negative. And how to go about working with judgment. So I think a combination of internal parts, or like internal family systems, which you're probably familiar with.
I'm not familiar with it.
So internal family systems is an amazing, I guess, modality created by this guy called Dick Schwartz. And it's basically like acknowledging the fact that we're not just one self, but we are made up of like multiple characters. Like we have multiple characters within us. So when you say, I'm judging someone else, it's helpful to ask like, which part of me is judging someone else? Some people will kind of create their own kind of fictions around their characters as well. Like maybe a character's like an inner child, maybe a character's like a protector. Maybe, you know, people create names for these. I think it's also helpful to work through the lens of archetypes as well. We were briefly talking about archetypes before we jumped on here, but like, is my internal warrior judging the other person because I don't feel safe for some reason? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really helpful to ask, like, I mean, obviously, like what might be underneath this judgment? Like how am I hoping to feel by judging this other person? And like, maybe it's, I feel safe. Maybe it's, I feel better than them, whatever it is. And then you kind of like follow the, you kind of like, it's almost like tracking, like you kind of follow the trail And like, and ultimately it's like, what am I generally, what am I unwilling to feel underneath all of that? And with judgment, often it will track back to a sense of, I feel shameful about something, or I feel ashamed of dot, dot, dot. And then in which case, going into some kind of somatic based experience to feel the underlying sense of shame that's present there, to allow it to kind of be integrated in into kind of greater wholeness, will then generally help to alleviate those specific patterns. And also kind of taking action around, what's a good example of this? Almost like trying on. I think it's really fun and helpful to practice role-playing different characters. My friend Buster Benson kind of does this really well, but it's like, if you know, if you're someone who's like, you know, really nice, like you're just so kind and you're nice and you're pleasant and, you know, you're very like agreeable, and then you find yourself judging other people that might be rude, like it's fun to be like, okay, what would it be like if I was like, if I was like a dick for a day, like what if I just went around like insulting people and it was just really rude, like how would that feel? And be comfortable with like the other end of the spectrum. Because chances are that there'd probably be some, you know, just something interesting there to explore. And so kind of going through this idea of like putting on different hats or playing different roles, I think can be really helpful as well. And like not taking it too seriously as well, and not judging the judging. Maybe that, yeah. I think that's part of it as well. Like just seeing, like, just like, oh, that's interesting. Like the mind's judging that person for wearing a silly top. Like, weird.
Well, yeah, all that was very helpful. And it reminds me of Byron Katie. I don't know if you're familiar. Are you familiar with Byron Katie? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was reading her book, Loving What Is. And in that, she explained how, you know, she hadn't smoked a cigarette for, I don't know, 10 years or something. And then she was in a perfect scenario to smoke the cigarette. And she did. And that's like when you were talking about trying on different hats, it's like, mm-hmm. she wasn't scared to try on that hat in that moment, mm-hmm. which I found there was some liberation. She wasn't saying, I'm never going to smoke again. She saw a situation where it would be the perfect thing to do, and she did it, and then she never did it again. And I thought there was something so powerful about that, because we think so often about abstinence and going 100% in the world we live in. But it's like something about doing it once and that's it is so freeing to me for some reason.
Yeah, I haven't heard that story, but what comes to mind is actually Eric and I talked about this to some degree in our conversation around his journey recovering from alcoholism. And I think that a trap that some former addicts can get into is they become like overly attached to the identity that they are a former addict. And so that becomes the new identity that they then get trapped into. And it sounds like Byron Katie was able to then kind of move out of that, like, oh, I am a former addict, I can't ever smoke a cigarette, into just like, oh, I'm a human, I no longer feel this compulsion. But if there's a great opportunity to smoke, I'm going to do it. Like, great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a powerful example, because I don't think we talk about it like that often in our society. But you know, I want to circle back to one thing you touched on at the beginning of the conversation, which was the tragic loss of your significant other, and how that, it seems like today, you are operating with such love, joy, and openness. But I feel as if a situation like that could ruin some people's lives, or be operating under the assumption that their life, they couldn't feel joy anymore because of something awful like that happening. So it leads me to ask, like, why do you think some people are transformed by pain in a positive direction and some in a negative direction? What's the difference?
Yeah, again, really beautiful question. And I think I do have a good answer for you. Yeah, so going back to that moment, for context, I was I knew that I wasn't great at expressing my emotions. Like, that was kind of pretty much the extent of what I knew. And I knew that I'd met people who had lost someone close to them and hadn't like fully metabolized the grief, and they'd turned into these like bitter shells of like husks of human beings. And that really scared me, because I was like, I don't want to become like that. And so kind of in that, in the few months afterwards, I kind of made this pretty like strong commitment to myself to really feel the pain and really grieve fully, and seeing the grieving as almost like an act of praising and an act of loving Sophie, who was no longer here. And so in the, yeah, I think 2 months afterwards, I did a Vipassana retreat, which was kind of like the beginning of it. And I really set out to, just to kind of really see if I could fully feel the full extent of the grief. And what I began to discover was that in the places where I was able to fully surrender, and this kind of comes back to like the freediving point of view, like when it's almost like grief was came in these tidal waves of intense emotion. And when I resisted that tidal wave, I suffered. But to the degree that I was able to just like allow it to like obliterate me and allow it to like really, obliterate parts of me, there was a beautiful like rawness and just love, honestly, on the other side of that. And kind of going through several of these, you know, waves that got increasingly more intense, like as I visited different places that we'd spent a lot of time together. I remember one particularly powerful one where I went to visit her memorial bench in a place called Leover Sands in Essex. And just like, as soon as I saw the bench, I just felt this like upsurge of emotion. I was like, whoa, this is going to be intense. And every step that I took towards that bench, it just amplified. And then as I finally reached the bench, I just like completely broke down, just like sobbing, tears, just everything. But in that, it's like your heart feels open and expanded in that place too. Like it's painful, but it's also beautiful at the same time. And so, and really, like, I think this is kind of the origin of my obsession around breathwork, is because it's showing people the beauty of inherent in fully feeling an emotion, and that it leads to greater wholeness and greater connection. So to answer your question, like why do some people also experience loss or tragedy but kind of get stuck there? I believe they get stuck because they don't have the tools or the spaciousness or the environment to fully feel the fully extent of the pain that they've been through. And I believe that to the degree that we're able to complete these kind of intense experiences that are stored in our nervous system, is the degree to which we're then able to feel joy and love and to feel kind of the other end of that spectrum on the other side. And so that's where I feel like breathwork is such a gift to the world, because it's a reliable, effective modality that allows people to really experience the depths of their pain and then also experience the joy, love, and connection that is there on the other side.
Eric Zimmer had this great quote, which was like, suffering equals pain times resistance. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you didn't have any resistance, or not any, but like it seemed like you had a very low level of resistance to mm-hmm. the pain you were feeling from how you're describing it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
yeah.
true?
Yeah. I couldn't put it better myself. And I think that with any emotion, actually, not only grief, but it's like examining. Rumi has this quote where he says, our task is to examine the barriers that get in the way of love. So it's really about exploring, like, why are we resisting this thing that wants to come through? And maybe we're judging it. Maybe we're often with grief, you know, anger can be a part of the grieving process. And if someone isn't able to express anger, then they'll kind of be stunted in that grieving process and they won't be able to fully complete it. So yeah, I think it's beautifully put. And it's also not, you know, like, it's also, I think it's important to say that this is also a process, and it would be easy to then go into like, okay, I'm going to judge myself where I have resistance to feeling certain things. Yeah. But there is a wisdom in the body where we only surface things that we're ready to then feel fully and process. And it's, we all have a certain capacity, a certain window of tolerance, and this takes time to kind of build, you know, months, years sometimes. So that's what comes to mind.
Yeah. How has working with anger, I know in previous podcasts you talked about how you talked about how anger is something you're recently exploring yourself, and how has that helped transform your relationship to what has happened, if at all?
I think that I think that there was a part of me that was angry at the systems which kind of gave rise to the conditions which led to Sophie taking her own life. And so she had bipolar, and she worked as a junior doctor, and it was essentially the lack of support at work and just the very high stress that junior doctors are put under, I think, all around the world, that led to the conditions where she had an anxiety attack and then made the decision to take her own life by overdosing on her medication. And so there was for sure anger around just like the tragedy that we have systems in place that give rise to conditions where this is a painfully common experience, and suicide rates are increasing in all different industries around the world, particularly in men as well, I think. And I think in that anger, there was also this part of me of like, well, I also want to kind of be part of changing that system as well. And so I think, and again, that's kind of part of what, you know, the work I'm doing around emotional resilience, the research report that I co-authored, Nervous System Mastery is a big part of that as well. And yeah, there's a sense of, I had a really great conversation with Joe Hudson, who is also on the podcast, and he talks about clean anger, like really clean anger that isn't unkinked. So he says like anger can kink in two ways. It can kink one way, which is like aggression, where you're like shouting at someone else and you're like venting. And the other is like passive aggressive, where you're like, I'm okay, like whatever. But you're actually really pissed off. But clean anger, when it's unkinked, is basically just determination. It's like clarity. It's like, no, this is not okay. Like, I'm going to change this. And it's like determination. And so, it's power too, right? It's real power. And so I think that by cultivating a healthier relationship with anger, it's also led to more determination and clarity around what I want to do and like the reason that I'm doing the work that I'm doing.
Yeah. When you just talked about clean anger being focused and determination, I just thought of Michael Jordan being able to take all the negative that he heard and all the negative things and be so angry about it, and then channel it to the direction that he wanted to go, which was winning championships. And I thought that sounded exactly like what you were just talking about, which is a powerful force, clearly, because it created an incredible level of greatness. So I think that's a beautiful place to really operate from. kind of turning to a lighter gear, like when you go into the levels of love within yourself, what are the things that come through today when you think about love? Like, how is love different today than it was, let's say, 5 years ago, since that is our normal place? Like, what does the depths of love look like differently?
You're really nailing it with the questions today. Yeah, I think two things come to mind. The first, and this is speaking from my perspective, the first is that, let's say 5, 10 years ago, I would associate someone or something external with being the source of the love. So maybe that was like my girlfriend at the time. Maybe it was like a great wave that I caught. And I would associate that feeling with the external thing or the person. And I think what has shifted is realizing that other humans, or, you know, dogs, whatever it is, they are essentially like stimulus or stimuli that elicit that feeling of love that is present within me. And they help, they're like gatekeepers, they help me to access that place of love that is there the entire time, regardless of what is going on in the external world. And, you know, this was a big thing, in a big kind of insight from the dark room as well, was that there doesn't need to be a reason to feel the love and the joy and the gratitude. Like, it is just an inherent state when the kind of the surface muck gets kind of cleared away. It's just deeply, deeply there. And so I think there has been a shift from grasping onto things or people in the external world that I feel like are my only connection to that feeling, to like, how can I just feel that for myself without, regardless of what's happening in the external world? There's a beautiful quote that joy is the happiness that doesn't depend on what happens. And I think that's really true. And then maybe the second piece is just, yeah. And this has really been, has kind of come through in my partnership with Kelly, particularly in the last year since we've been married. It's just been the felt experience of being in love, just the actual feelings just increase more than, like, I can't tell you how many times I've just been like blown away or just like in tears because something so beautiful, like a poem that she wrote, or we're going for a walk and you just see something beautiful and you just get moved to tears and it's like, fuck, like it's so beautiful. And what I didn't realize was just how closed off, I guess, I had been for most of my childhood to the full spectrum of that experience. And I imagine there's still much further to go. Like that's the hope anyway. And it's just the less that I resist and the more that I feel comfortable expressing, again, the full spectrum of emotions, the more that I feel like my heart is just open to feeling this like beautiful connection and intimacy with the world. I think that's really what it comes down to. Zach Stein and Mark Gaffney talk about this idea that we're going through a global intimacy disorder. And I think that really it's like, it's an increasing intimacy with all things, with humans, with the natural world, with ourselves, obviously. And I think that's the journey. And yeah, I hope it continues to get even deeper and to continue surprising me.
What can we do? It was a beautiful, beautiful answer. What can we do to deepen those feelings or open those feelings within ourselves? What are like some practical things that that can that we can think about?
I think there's two approaches. One is metta meditation is very juicy. I did a 10-day metta retreat at Spirit Rock a number of years ago, and I remember feeling out, and I remember emerging on the other side and like secretly wishing other people that I was seeing like in the supermarket, like, I really hope you have a great day without saying it, but just like secretly saying that to myself. And just in that state that I think lasted for several weeks of just like feeling good as a result of, and the process of metta meditation, for those who aren't familiar, is essentially just sending loving kindness first to another human that it's really easy to love, or maybe it's your dog, and then it's like choosing a stranger and kind of wishing them well, wishing them love, wishing them safety, whatever the mantra is. And then finally it's directing that towards yourself. It's like truly feeling, and like feeling the energy behind the words that you're saying as well. I think that's the key. It's like, you know, some people might say, may all beings be happy and free. I think my mantra at the time was just, I see you, I love you. Hmm. I see you, I love you. And just repeating that kind of over and over again. and then I think the other side of it is honestly is kind of the shadow work piece. It's like finding out what are the like quote unquote negative emotions that we are unwilling to feel, because they limit our capacity to feel on the other end of the spectrum. So mm-hmm. to the degree that we can feel and express shame, anger, rage, grief, all these things, it then increases our capacity to feel on the other end of the spectrum, because we're not numbing ourselves anymore. That's what comes to mind.
That's beautiful. Very helpful indeed. Well, I think that's a beautiful place to wrap up this wonderful conversation. I'm really grateful, like truly grateful for just your time. And I really feel a sense of ease and a sense of peace from talking to you today. So I want to thank you for that. Because you've clearly lit up those aspects in me. And that's a real blessing. So I'm really honored and grateful for you spending time here today. And thank you.
Thank you, Danny. Yeah, I also really just really appreciated like the thoughtfulness of your questions. And I can feel your caring and like your desire to learn. Like there's a genuine sense of curiosity there that really brings out that part of me as well. So thank you for doing this. I think your podcast's amazing. Really appreciate your time as well.
Where can people connect with you further?
Sure. So Twitter is a great place. Johnny Miller, M1LLER. And then my website is curioushumans.com. And they can find links to the podcast and newsletter. And if they're interested in nervous system mastery, there's an upcoming cohort in June. And the website is nsmastery.com. And there's details and application form and stuff on there. So it would be great if people want to check that out. And yeah, love receiving emails, feedback, thoughts from people. That's about it.
Awesome. Well, we'll link those below, and really grateful for your time.
Likewise. Thank you.